Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to LSE for today's hybrid event, Eco-Social Contracts for Sustainable and Just Futures. My name is George Kunath. I am an Associate Professor of Education and Academic Lead for the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity, based at the LSE's International Inequalities Institute. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Najma Mohammed, Manisha Desai, Ashfaq Khalfan, and Mary Robinson to both our online audience and those who are joining us in person. Najma Mohammed is an Atlantic Fellow for Social and Economic Equity, the head of Nature-Based Solutions for UNEP World Conservation Monitoring Center, and co-editor of Eco-Social Contracts for Sustainable and Just Futures. Manisha Desai is the Executive Director of the Center for Changing Systems of Power and the Empowerment Trust Endowed Professor for Global Citizenship at Stony Brook University. She is also a co-editor of Eco-Social Contracts for Sustainable and Just Futures. Ashfaq Khalfan is the director of the Sustainability Regulation Observatory and distinguished policy fellow at LSE's Global School of Sustainability. He was previously Climate Justice Director of Oxfam America and Law and Policy Director at Amnesty International. Mary Robinson is the first woman president of Ireland, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, former chair of the Elders, and a passionate advocate for gender equality, women's participation in peace building, human dignity, and climate justice. For any social media users in this audience, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEEvents. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as podcasts, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to the panel. For our online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature on the left hand of your screen. Please include your name and affiliation. And those of you attending in person, I will let you know when the floor is open for questions. Please raise your hand and wait for the stewards with a roving microphone to get to you. I will try to ensure a range of questions from both our online and in-person audiences. But now I'm delighted to hand over to Najma for an introduction on the Eco-Social Contracts for Sustainable and Just Futures.
So good evening, everyone, and thank you for braving the storm and joining us here this evening. It feels like writing this book has been like braving, you know, the storm that we have in the world today. And it was written with a lot of hope, which I think we are still very much trying to keep alive. So the book brings together really 30 contributions from across the world, more than 50% of them from global majority. It includes leading scholars, artists, activists, practitioners, to really begin to explore what a renewed social contract could look like in a time of overlapping crises, the storms that we're facing today. The book is really an invitation to not only collectively imagine what the future could look like, but to look at what pathways, what practices are already taking us there. It's difficult to do full justice to the valuable contributions in the book. I'm really happy that Mary and Manisha, who made contributions to the book, Manisha as a co-editor, and Mary through the essay that she contributed. But read the book, it's online and available from this week. So I'll try and highlight some of the key elements that actually, you know, led to the book. In a sense, our connections as co-editors happened through this research practitioner network called the Eco-Social Contract Network. That's co-hosted by the UN Research Institute for Social Development and the Green Economy Coalition. And that's where we met one another. You know, this was a space for thinking, for challenge, for dreaming and hoping and looking at where the alternatives that were already showing that another way of organizing our economies, organizing our societies was already possible. So it brought us together, you know, in a way to where we met and where we started the thinking around the book. So the network was a wonderful place for dialogue, but also for dissent. And we don't all four think exactly the same. And I think that was a really good experience for us to write it, to write the book, you know, together. So I think one of the inspirations was the work of Andres to start putting together what is this eco-social contract. And Andres came out in the 2022 flagship report with some of the key principles that should underlie a new social contract. And the book builds on this, doesn't entirely use this framework, but builds on this and takes it, I think, in some interesting directions. So what do we mean when we speak about an eco-social contract? The fascinating thing when you've got 30 contributors to the book is that there is the multiple interpretations that we wanted comes out in the book, from radical ecological democracy to ecological jurisprudence to how do you work in the multilateral system and look at the Paris Agreement or the Global Biodiversity Framework as a new form of social agreement in the world. So I think that's a very healthy way to have approached the book. But we've basically looked at the new as an eco-social contract as collective agreements, formal or informal, and at different levels of governance that redefine our relationship with each other and with the planet. And I think that's one of the critical differences that this book seems to sort of bring to the fore. I spoke about the storm that all of us braved to come here, the storm in the, you know, this is the challenge that we looked at. We wanted to not only face the challenge and have that moral courage and bravery to name it, but we wanted to think, how could we find pathways out of it? So we realized that we were facing major challenges, growing, you know, inequality, the triple planetary crisis of environmental degradation, pollution, and climate change was disproportionately impacting the poorest and most vulnerable communities and nations. And even though we have an agreed principle called common but differentiated responsibilities, we know that the responsibility in reality is not being borne equally. I think all of us know that we have declining trust in institutions, in our governments, and people feel unrepresented by their political systems and leaders. And so it's no surprise that voices were beginning to speak throughout the pandemic about the fact that we have a broken social contract. And you kept on hearing people saying, we are in a moment where we're really needing to support one another. And, you know, and so this was the challenge that we were facing, but we had a counter to that. The demand for a different kind of world was growing. It was growing from all directions, from young people, from those connecting the climate and the social justice agenda, from the resurgence and the focus on racial injustices. And we could see that this is a movement that we're beginning to work together to actually, you know, look for a different pathways to a different world. And that was what brought us to write this book. And what the book is really about is to identify pathways that break from this dominant social paradigm that's actually built on the exploitation of people and nature, to actually reassess the purpose, the goal, and the vision of our societies and economies by people so that they deliver the well-being and prosperity that people really want, to draw from the diversity of ideas and imaginaries and ways of understanding the relationship between people and between people and nature, and to realize that there's not one social contract but many, and then to halt this democratic backsliding that we're beginning to see in some of the, you know, strongest democracies in the world at the moment. The good news is that existing social contracts have often been renegotiated in times of crisis. I can say that from my own experience. I'm a South African. I was, you know, voted when I was on my third year geography field trip for the first time and started doing my environmental work with the constitution in my hand. I know what a renewed social agreement can do. And so a time of crisis is often a moment where you can rethink, you can, you know, put in, you know, new ways, and we're seeing it. So the book doesn't put forward this idea that we need this utopia. It puts forward this idea that we have to imagine, we have to plan, we have to design new ways of interacting with one another and with the world, and we need to test them, you know, at scale. We need to move way beyond, you know, sort of 37 citizens' assemblies and start making citizens' assemblies part of climate governance, for instance. And so we're not short of finding, you know, examples. There are many case studies in the book on eco-social contracts. They have pragmatic visions for the world that we want. They offer windows into transformations already happening. For example, we've got contributions focusing on climate justice movements in Latin America, food sovereignty movements, climate finance and philanthropy, and as I mentioned earlier, some of the global agreements that we have, such as the Paris Agreement and the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Framework. And we had the hope and the vision that together these actually begin to signal a move in how we relate to each other and hopefully to our planet, from domination and extraction towards values such as reciprocity, care, justice, and moving from social contracts to eco-social contracts, because that's been one of the features of most modern social contract theory, was that nature is virtually absent. What will you find in the book? You will find, you know, chapters organized around sort of four sections, focusing on these ideas and visions that we really need to tap into. And there's a wonderful phrase that I love. It's a very short piece from Vandana Shiva on that is entitled Monocultures of the Mind. And we really try to tackle that, to show that, you know, there's a lot of visions, alternative understandings, worldviews that can influence the way we design, the way we run our economies, the way we run our cities and our societies. So the first part of the book really tries to bring in new ideas. The second and third part gets practical, gets real, and starts looking at existing agreements and begins to test how do they fare against these kind of new values of justice, of reciprocity, of care for the earth, of well-being. And so there's, you know, 10 chapters in sections 2 and 3 that look at that. And the last part of the book then focuses on people-centered movements and alliances for eco-social contracts, very grassroots, level examples of where communities are self-organizing and delivering on the economies and the societies that they want, and not always waiting for the state to step in. We have interspersed with these four sections some really thought-provoking and visionary essays. Mary produced one of them, and I think they help us, you know, see where this lands, you know, in the world. So the book offers, I would say, not just a collection of insights, it's a convergence of lived experience, wisdom, and regenerative practices, policies and systems and processes and institutions that can actually offer a systemic critique of current paradigms, visionary alternatives and engagements with plural knowledges so that we can get rid of the sort of monocultures in our minds, practice-based insights across regions and sectors, and then pathways to transformation and governance innovation and inspiration. I mean, the book speaks about collective agencies, and in many of the cases you would see how collective agencies had come together, you know, at different levels of governance. So I sort of wanted to end with a quote that I always go back to, and it's one of the introductory chapters in the book, and I always... I'm very pleased that we had the contribution from an artist and an academic from the Caribbean, Chris Walker, and he wrote, it's the introductory, it's the second chapter of the book, and he writes, it's a solo performance that he's delivered, and it's basically based on themes of the environmental crisis, resilience, and Afro-Caribbean cultural traditions. But I think the message that Chris shares is really profound, because he does speak about facing our collective grief, because I think the crisis that we sketched out at the start of this, what prompted us to write the book, can be paralyzing. You know, it can steep one in grief. But then it takes us to how to reclaim our humanity and move forward with greater purpose and clarity. So I'd like to finish just with by reading it. And so this is the title of his performance, is Seaweed King. So he says, at its heart, Seaweed King is both a process and a praxis. It embodies a rupture from entrenched anthropocentric ideologies, proposing an alternative relationship with the planet, one rooted in care, interdependence, and collective responsibility. The grief carried by Seaweed King is inescapable, an acknowledgement of ecological loss and cultural erosion. Yet grief must not stagnate. It must transform into action. But within the depths of loss lies the potential for growth, reparation, and new forms of being. And we invite you to be part of I think, a movement to tap into radical hope so that we can move forward with purpose and clarity.
Thank you, Najma, for the wonderful introduction. Now it's a time for panelists to share some of their reflections on the book. So the first question is one of our favorite questions: what is a takeaway from the book? But before I give you time to gather your thoughts, I want to say what is my takeaway from this book. When challenged with the multiple fronts, climate and various human rights violations and so on, I think what I've learned from the book is not to see the knowledge systems in isolation, but see it as a kind of in dialogue. So the question about the, here is also indigenous knowledge system that you explain, you know, in the book, which is like Ubuntu and also Eco Swaraj and Sumat Kalsi, and all this is, and then also your own reflections on liberation eco-theology, the need to see that all in dialogue with each other. That sort of helps to form a kind of eco-social contract in some way. So that's my takeaway from the book. Now, open to you, and you can share what's your takeaway from this book. Let's start with Mary Robinson, please.
Thank you. You'll forgive me if I, first of all, I'm very happy to be back in LSE, and I just wanted to pay a warm personal tribute to the person who invited me a number of times to events here in LSE, Conor Geertie, Professor Conor Geertie. I knew Conor as a lifelong friend. I knew he was involved as Professor of Human Rights here in LSE, and he in fact involved me in building up the Center for Human Rights, and then he had a Center for Political Affairs. And the point really about Conor was he was not only a wonderful teacher, he was also a wonderful human being. And he created that sense of fun, of learning that was actually enjoyable. And I think that is something very special. He was a member for 9 years. He was a trustee of my own foundation in Ireland, the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice. And he loved coming over to Dublin for these occasions. And we loved having him and having fun together, especially in the evening. But he was one of a kind. He was a very special man. And I just wanted to say it here in LSE, one of a kind. Thank you. What I like about the book, the eco-social contract, is it's also a contract with nature. That, for me, was the most important, because we've got so distant from nature. Yeah. And, you know, I've learned, especially in many, many contacts with indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. How to borrow from their wisdom. And I mean really borrow from their wisdom. And when I became UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in 1997, I discovered that I had another job as well. I was the something of the decade of indigenous peoples. I was organizing the decade, and I was kind of, how many are there? At least 400 million worldwide. It'd be a lot more now. This was in 1997. And when I went into the first meeting as High Commissioner, I was given a UN speak text that I didn't even understand myself, so I couldn't possibly share this. So I told the story of how the Choctaw people had helped the Irish people during the terrible famine in Ireland in 1847. They had raised $173 for the relief of Irish famine victims in 1847. That was a lot of money. And it's a story we know well in Ireland. And when I was President of Ireland, I went to Oklahoma in 1997, 150 years later, to thank the Choctaw people. And then a few months later, I became High Commissioner. So I told the story, and somehow it connected in a human way. And I kind of I liked that some of them even called me Mama Mary, which was fine. The wisdom of nature. And I want to sort of also add, because really I was focused in my short contribution to the book on governance.
Yeah.
And since then I've been thinking that we need to root the eco-social contract in human rights. And there's a perfect part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we in the human rights community have neglected. And that is Article 29, the first sentence, which I know knows by heart, but I also corrected, because it uses he meaning she, and I use they. But otherwise I'm word for word, I hope. I think I am. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full expression of their personality is possible. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full expression of their personality is possible. So unless you know you have duties to the community, and unless you do something about it, you yourself don't reach your full potential. And of course, we all know that if you give to the other, if you're involved in community, you get far more back than you give. So it's a deep wisdom, but we've neglected it in the human rights community. And I think eco-contracts is the ideal way to bring it back. No, sorry if I'm a bit long, but...
Thank you so much. I think that's a very, very important insight. I really like the fact that you highlighted that entering into that contract with nature. I think that's very important. And also the fact in your own chapter, I really liked your chapter which gives emphasis on governance. And that is also so significant in the context of our discussion.
Governance at all levels.
Absolutely, Thank you very much. Ashfaq?
Yeah, thank you very much. And what a wonderful book. I'm going to be a lawyer and pick out a few, I'd be a bit nitpicky. Don't worry. In the sense, I'm going to go into a few of the details. So George talked about the various traditions where these principles are reflected. Najma's chapter talks about various Islamic declarations. And would you not believe it, like a collection of scholars from Muslim countries call for the ratification of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, a treaty that talks about the phasing out of fossil fuels, many from countries which are fossil fuel dependent. That's really interesting. There's a discussion of liberation theology. Now, Judeo-Christian thinking gets a bit of a kicking. I don't know who's responsible for that. The anthropocentric, patriarchal approaches. But of course, the book makes clear that that's really with all of the religious traditions. There's different readings. I think nobody would be surprised by that. But the depth of it goes. It just goes to show that there's so many different sources of traditions that build this out. It's not just international law. It's not just Enlightenment thinking extended. It's not just what comes out of the universes. There's so much out there that allows the struggle for achieving a more just and sustainable future, one that draws on so many different sources, intellectual sources, that it makes one quite hopeful, really, for the way we can go forward. So another point, just to mention on the rights of nature that Mary Robinson talked about. This book, you can download it. Please download it and look at page 195. There's a wonderful chart there. In 1990, in terms of legal recognition of the rights of nature, barely a handful. In the present day, or at least when you finish the book, it was more than 500 sources, constitutions, laws, regulations, international standards, and it just goes up exponentially. It looks like an AI chart, a chart about the use of AI. So look at that. It's fascinating. International law does not yet reflect that. In terms of human rights law, in terms of the rights of nature, but it's only a matter of time. The right to a healthy environment, which the book talks about, was recognized by the General Assembly, what, 4 or 5 years ago. So you see the trend there. The last thing I'll mention as my take as a major takeaway was this wonderful sentence that exploit, and I think this was in the chapter by Asaf Najma and Patrick Hutchins, exploitation of nature and marginalized human communities often go hand in hand, reinforcing cycles of domination and extraction. I found that really interesting. It goes how we have to deal with the inequality and nature and climate crisis hand in hand.
Thank you, Ashfaq. Thank you for bringing out some of those important points, insights from the book and sharing with us. Thank you very much. Over to Manisha.
Yeah, I think for me there are several, but first of all I want to thank Najma and you all for inviting me here. And I think what is most importantly reflected in the book is the collaborative nature. Not only because we were four co-editors, we come from four very different kinds of spaces, and yet we saw commonality that we needed to work collaboratively if you're going to think about the large issues that the world faces. And for me, the sort of three important takeaways. I think one had to do with the ways in which how we rethink our current moment. And so the focus was not just on the crisis at hand, which we all know about and which we all lament and fear and grieve, but also the possibilities. And for me, the politics of possibilities are always very important. As a social movement scholar, that's where I come from. People on the ground are always the ones that are a source of inspiration. And so to me, that was kind of the very important takeaway, is that there are people all around who are rethinking, not just rethinking, but reenacting policies. So that's kind of one of the biggest takeaway. The second was, and I think maybe George mentioned it, was the intersectionality. And so for me, the way in which I think our chapters all reflect is, you know, what I call three different ways of thinking about social justice, which is epistemic justice, aesthetic justice, and social justice. And by epistemic justice, obviously, I mean that knowledge doesn't just reside in the academy. It doesn't reside, you know, among those who are lettered, but it resides in a lot of different places. And how do we think about, you know, what Raven O'Connell, a very well-known feminist colleague and dear friend, talks about, solidarity of epistemologies, that there are different epistemologies, and how do they come in conversation with each other? And conversation with each other doesn't necessarily mean that we're all going to agree. It means that we could actually be critical and challenge, but we are still open and are going to continue engaging each other rather than sort of, you know, canceling out people because we have different trajectories and different ways of coming together. Aesthetic justice, Najma read from Chris Walker, who's again a friend and fellow activist in the US. And it is really important that for a lot of people, art and creativity, and all of us have the potential and ability to be creative in different ways, and how that can inform and how that reaches people and brings them into thinking and acting around different ways of producing justice and addressing the crisis that we have. And finally, social justice was the last section, which actually talks about the ways in which social movements throughout have actually worked on things from food justice to thinking about governance to thinking about the EU Green Deal. All of these things in some ways are problematic. None of them are perfect solutions. And to me, I think I was one of the ones among the four of us who didn't really like the term contract, because to me, contract is very instrumental, and instrumentality is what has gotten us where we are. So I think we need to go beyond the contract, but we couldn't sort of agree on where we're going to go. And that's something you learn in collaboration, that you don't always agree on everything. We don't all agree. And I don't come from a UN space. The rest of my colleagues have worked in UN spaces, and I have problems with that space as well. And those kind of tensions are also reflected in our four, you know, sections. But we also at the same time recognize that we do need, you know, lots of conversations across what I tend to call, I do transnational feminism, but I also now focus on translocal, that centering the nation, when the nation and the state are so problematic right now, where they're kind of seeding grounds, we need to really think about other kinds of local actors who come together across different borders. And I think the book also reflects that. So I think those kind of, for me, were the main takeaways. Working through differences, working at the ways in which people are working, reimagining as well as reenacting. And I think this is kind of where I will stop, because I think feminists, particularly Gibson Graham, talk about the ways in which capitalism is not completely overdetermined, right? We tend to think, particularly in this moment, that neoliberal capitalism has captured all the spaces, including our imaginations, but we actually see lots of ways in lots of different spaces where actually there are what Eric Olin Wright used to call real utopias, that is, where people are practicing what feminists of an older generation called prefigurative politics. That is, ways in which we actually enact and live in community, as Mary said, the ways we want the future to be.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Manisha, for sharing that. Especially, particularly, I liked your chapters, all the chapters there. Particularly what I liked you just now said, in the face of differences, how do we work together? And this is something, a priority at the OFSI program. My colleague, Professor Armenish Kenyon, is sitting there. So that's something also there will be always differences, but we want to work together, negotiating differences to reach agreements or to go forward. And thank you so much for sharing and highlighting that. Over to you, Najma.
I had the first this, I should get the last one. I mean, I think I would definitely echo what Mary said. The takeaway for me was that what's missing from a lot of our, if we don't call it a contract, let's call it an agreement, is a visibility of nature. And I think the book, you know, throughout brings that. And building on what Manisha said, that really my second takeaway is that the book tackles a number of injustices, climate and ecological injustice. But what I found particularly brave, and I wish we would have done more of it, was epistemic injustice. You know, I'm glad that we opened the book with chapters, I think, that challenge it, but I think we could have done more. Because I do think our worldviews and our understanding of the relationship between people and nature is rooted in a very dominating and domineering paradigm, a very instrumental paradigm that's, you know, whereas whether it's in indigenous people's traditions, whether it's in people's, in the sort of communitarian visions that we've engaged with, it's rooted in the relational values between people, and between people and their leaders, and between people and nature. And so I do think bringing some of that, addressing some of that epistemic injustice in what's available to imagine is a lot of work that we still need to do as someone that often works in spaces where there's very little openness. I think the fact that we've moved from beyond a critique to looking at what is possible and looking at the imperfection of what we do have already. We do look at the Paris Agreement, we look at the EU Green Deal, there's an interrogation by European scholars on the EU Green Deal. Is it really serving the people of Europe? Is it this lovely piece of counterwork in the EU space called the Shared Green Deal? Is it a Shared Green Deal? Is it a deal rooted in the Commission, or is it rooted in communities? So I think the fact that we moved from beyond the thinking and the normative ideas and principles into what's existing in the world, what inspires, you know, change and action. And I think for an audience like this, I think many of them would be researchers or academics, is actually that connection between academics and thinkers and practitioners, and to bring the thinking and the ideas not only from the academic world, as Manisha said, but to open it to all knowledges. It's been quite, you know, a journey for all of us. I think we've grown.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Najma. I think when I was reading, it's what is already present there that often we miss. That the foundations that exist, and I think your reinterpretation of Islam, especially from the perspective of liberation eco-theology, I thought it was very interesting, because we often think that, okay, religions they tend to be anthropocentric, but then there is also that dimension of bringing nature to it, and in your interpretation of theology, I think you brought it out very clearly. I think that was very, very insightful. Thank you. We're going to the next question. And this is, I'm going to read out. The book is described as a guide for transformation for seekers of hope. What gives you the most hope that a regenerative future is politically and socially feasible, given the current geopolitical situation and governance context? I know we're talking about the positive thing. Now we have to engage with the negative and come out with that feeling of hope. Can I start with Manisha?
Ooh, okay. I guess why not? I think in the book what we see, and I will actually focus on one of the chapter that Ashish Kothari, a friend and activist from India, wrote about, and I want to focus on that because they've already been dealing for the past 15 years what some of us in the US and other parts of the world are dealing with, which is the rise of authoritarianism and fascism and Hindu fundamentalism. And I think even in that context, what they found was working locally with communities and looking at the ways in which communities were coming up with, whether it was, you know, very simple communities right in Ladakh, which in itself is problematically located in Kashmir, which has issues with, you know, China, India, and Pakistan, and yet people in Ladakh were able to work together. And what they were doing was both challenging Modi's neoliberal policies, challenging their local leaders, because they also tended to have local community organizations, which were primarily, not surprisingly, male-dominated. And so the women were then, you know, challenging them to bring, you know, them into the conversation. So they were both reaching back to traditional relationships, but also challenging them. And so working at the local, traditional, and neoliberal level at the state level. And so you kind of see that working with local communities, you can begin to challenge the development policies from, you know, 1950s on, but particularly the neoliberal policies post-liberalization in India post-1991. And so to me, that kind of conversation where these are small communities in Ladakh, in some ways surrounded by a lot of violence, violence of war, violence of neoliberalism, and yet finding the ability to come together and work and actually see real differences locally in their communities. So for example, some of the chapters that Ashish, I mean, some of the struggles that Ashish talks about were around tourism, because Ladakh is a very big tourist destination. And as you can well imagine, tourism has a lot of consequences, not just on the ecology, but also a lot of the local resources get redirected in terms of, you know, water, housing towards tourists rather than local. And they were able to put in place policies that would challenge that. So I think even if in that context we could see people working, and, you know, living and working in the United States, we've seen finally, you know, even Trump had to get ICE out of Minnesota, thanks to people in Minnesota for every day being out there and challenging the state. And so I think it takes people working together and not always succeeding, but nonetheless being there, putting your bodies out, you know, on the streets. And I think that makes a difference. And we sort of saw that in several of our chapters of people being able to do that, even in the context of fundamentalism and fascism.
Thank you. Thank you, Vanessa, for that seeds of hope. Ashfaq, would you like to take over from that point?
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm 51% hopeful and 49%. I think the Kumi Naidu's essay in the book said that this is a decisive decade, really. I mean, it really is, in terms of whether we go over, exceed us, particularly on climate and you know, the risk of tipping points. So we have a chance. That's so. I mean, even in spite of all of the you know, the sort of authoritarian nationalism, the approach being taken by Trump, at the same time, there still is progress happening in many places. I think this was after the book was finalized, but the High Seas Treaty just was agreed and it's come to force. It sets aside something like 30% of the high seas to protect marine biodiversity. It's biodiversity beyond national boundaries. Right now, there's a convention being negotiated at the United Nations on tax, which was the driving force for it was African governments. And African civil society groups who work in this area are firmly behind that agenda, and so it's, you know, it's happening. There's very likely going to be a convention. Now, of course, the European governments are doing as much as they can to limit the effectiveness of it. But you know, it just goes to show there is some hope. And of course, even Nisha talked about the United States and in terms of the environment, but people have to remember that the majority of the United States population and its economy, however you want to measure it, is based in states where the governments and legislators are formally committed to the Paris Agreement. They're not being heard enough, but they are, you know, going ahead and continuing with carbon mitigation measures and doing quite a lot in that regard. So, you know, U.S. emissions are very likely going to keep on going down in spite of what Donald Trump is doing. So those sorts of things give a bit of hope.
Mary Robinson, if I may ask, you've got such a lot of experience.
I agree basically with the points made by Minusha and Ashfaq. I think, you know, it's what's happening on the ground that can give us hope, that so many communities are determined to move forward. But, you know, from a governance point of view, what we need is to recognize that the problems require all of government and the layers below. So we need to try to connect not just governments at the national level, but also regional, local authorities, cities, business, civil society, women's groups, women's leadership, etc. And just to give you a small example, I'm involved with a group of women leaders in what we call Project Dandelion. We've chosen a weed, the dandelion, because it grows on all continents. It's very resilient. You can get rid of it if you want to. It's also got deep roots that regenerate the soil, and there's no waste. You can eat or drink every part of the dandelion, and how do you spread it? Just blow. And actually, when children blow, they often wish. So it's a wish and a blow, which is even better. And what we've managed to do at the initial stage was to link together in a collaborative way the women-led climate nature and nature groups at the more global level, who come to conferences on climate or the UN General Assembly. They used to all be in their little silos, guarding their funding, you know, not being too open about anything for fear they might lose out. And now everybody's affirming the other, supporting the other, so we've become much stronger. And we've taken this kind of added strength to what purpose? To link in real solidarity with the women at grassroots, the smallholder farmers, the indigenous women, those who are making the difference on the ground, who get less than 1%, less than half of 1% of climate finance, less, you know, don't get the support and recognition. And that connection, I find very hopeful. Mm-hmm. And it's based on trust. There's a lot of trust between women who are engaged in this. And whoever we talk to, we know we're on the same side. We know we share the same. We may come from very different backgrounds, but somehow there's a compelling desire to work together in a collaborative way as women leaders with women leaders at all levels, including young women leaders, young climate activists, etc. And apart from anything else, it's fun to do because we're seeing the roots. I mean, we're learning from wonderful grassroots organizations like the Self-Employed Women's Association, which Manisha and I both know very well. But it's a very remarkable example, but it's not the only by any manner of means. There are many, many. And I think the more we can make these kind of connections, links, which the book is championing at all levels, especially in the governance.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Najma, you want to continue sharing hope? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think something in the multilateral, the intergovernmental space that I've been seeing is I call them the coalitions that have moral courage and practical solutions. And it's not the UN. I mean, I think it's a coalition of the willing. So a coalition just like the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, High Ambition Coalition for Nature, Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty, which is a mixture of governments, of corporations, of civil society organizations, and really have the force of wanting to shift a system. They're up against a lot of challenges, but I think that gives me a lot of hope. And I think it's a wake-up call for our multilateral and intergovernmental processes, because they're able to move faster and a lot more agile. I am. I find it hopeful that I'm seeing, you know, citizens actually engage in the in climate, in environment policy making, in economic policy making, and actually having an opportunity to shape and to give their ideas so that the policies and the investments actually align with what people want and need. I think gives me a lot of hope. I mean, I live in the UK at the moment, and to have seen, you know, communities and citizens engage in citizens' assemblies. UK's got an incredible people's plan for nature, which I think I showed up there. It's a really beautiful vision. And now we've got to take those visions and make them real, right? I remember when we had this conversation about the social contract when I was working at the Green Economy Coalition, and we had this big discussion about, because strategic climate litigation was on the up, and we were saying, well, we've just got to take our governments, you know, to court, take the corporations and the governments to court. I mean, that should not be the first course, I would think. But I find that hopeful, that the climate litigation is on the increase. And particularly, I think the LSE, the Grantham Institute, does the sort of every year, I think, they do the assessment of the climate litigation. And I think they show, you know, the biggest rise are actually in countries in the global south, and they are often not climate focused. They are focused on, you know, health and on housing and on water security and on food, which is how we've always thought about climate
and nature. Global trends in climate litigation. Next edition comes out in June. We'll be launched here.
Done your part for the LEC.
Thanks, Najma. Ashfaq, this question is for you. I'm going to read out, and you start. What remains the most significant knowledge gap or contested area within eco-social contract? Contract ideas and actions that scholars and practitioners should prioritize.
Okay. So the book talks a lot about forming coalitions and transcending barriers, and there's a lot of guidance on how to do that. And there's a lot there about how to achieve change bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, and there's a lot, and there's a huge amount of literature on that, on techniques that work and the various forms of coalition that can be brought together. But of course, not all the change is needed at the national level. Some of it has to be transnational, and that's incredibly difficult. It's so, at Amnesty, we worked trying to form global, coalitions of actors, and we agreed on principles, but the implementation was really hard, and funding and power became a huge barrier there. And I was speaking as an organization that had power and was called out for it. that sort of transnational coalition building is particularly hard. How do we convince, and, you know, we find, if you look at public opinion, people support redistributive approaches. They support progressive taxation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the polling in terms of providing funding overseas, the support for anything more than just modest transfers is very low. I think there's more support for fairer rules. I think very few people would say we want unfair rules that benefit us. But that's a huge challenge. And in an area where the humanitarian assistance is being dramatically lowered, and this government, I think, in the UK, has done worse than the United States. So that's a big challenge. In terms of the climate justice issues, $400 billion damage, loss and damage, is occurring every year in the global south, particularly in the most affected countries, you know. And there isn't a public constituency, at least at the moment, supporting that. So that's a challenge. How do you get that? I see that as a major knowledge gap.
Thank you. Feel free to skip also. Not everyone doesn't have to answer. Okay. So if you want to comment on this, especially the challenges and the knowledge gap, please feel free. Anybody?
to me, it's not so much the knowledge gap as much as, you know, usually people talk about the lack of political will, but I think that's kind of a misnomer, because what goes on is a political will to continue status, you know, the status quo. So I think one of the kind of big gaps, and, you know, particularly given my location, that's a big conversation in the U.S., which hasn't quite, I think, made it, that might help, is on reparations. Because I think when we're talking about coloniality and sort of colonial state in which we live, if you're not truly talking about reparations, we're not going to get to redistribution, we're not going to get to taxation. So I think that's, it's not so much a knowledge gap, but I think given what we could put in the book, it's not something that we have there. But I think because there's been a lot of work done even by economists in terms of what reparation would look like, what does, you know, and how we can actually fund it. Because when we want to, we fund lots of things. And we saw during the COVID pandemic, we could come up with things very quickly and make a lot of changes. So it's not that there is a lack of political will. I think the political will is to continue what we have. And so I think we need, you know, I think so, to me, it's not so much a knowledge gap as much as kind of mobilizing or organizing, I think, the ways in which we can talk about reparations and redistribution.
You know, our audience also are waiting for a lot of questions, so I'm going to quickly go on to a couple of short questions, and I think these are important questions and I really like them. How does an eco-social contract translate into day-to-day governance? What is one concrete example of policy that embodies this shift? May I ask you, Mary Robinson?
Well, I've just come 2 weeks ago from seeing this working on the ground. I mentioned the Self-Employed Women's Association. I knew Ila Bhatt, who founded SEWA more than 50 years ago. She became an elder, one of the elders that Nelson Mandela brought together, and she was a wonderful elder because she kept us thinking. She would pose a question, and we didn't answer it well. Why do we eat food grown more than 100 miles from where we live? You know, that sort of question, and it kind of fell in this group at the time. But I've been watching what they're doing. It's a wonderful feminist, Gandhi-inspired, religious, but across all religions, across all trades, the poorest women, and through organization, they can provide all kinds of health care, children's care. Now heat, and not just heat, but climate shock insurance for extreme heat, for heavy rain, and for cyclones. Tiny amounts of money during the hours of the day that you can't work in the heat, or tiny amounts of money if your crop has been completely destroyed by persistent rain. These can be done automatically, small amounts. They've pioneered that. They've pioneered solar energy, and with their cotton farmers, it was the salt miners. There were so many of them, and I was out in the desert 2 years ago with them, so I see what they were doing. And you see the big solar panels now. They changed from diesel to solar, and there were so many of them. They got carbon credits. Can you believe? You know? Now, they were angry that the consultant who helped them to get the carbon credits took more than 40%, but still, they got tiny amounts of carbon credit. So that's a kind of... I'm only illustrating, it's the power of organizing when it's done with complete solidarity. I have to say it benefited from a shared spirituality, and there were so many lessons to learn, it's hard to replicate fully in all places, but I think we can all learn a lot from it.
Thank you very much. Anyone else want to respond to that?
I was also going to give an example from India, but I won't, since Mary's already talked about. But I will actually talk about an example from the United States, where a lot of climate scientists have come up with a term of cumulative climate impact. So that looks at housing, that looks at education, that looks at the environment, of course, and then human rights. And this is kind of, you know, what you had mentioned earlier about different levels. Mm. And most of this is happening at the level of the city. And I think that's another thing that I think we need to think about, because more and more, most of the people in the world today live in cities, mm. more than in rural areas, and how cities can be, in some ways, the incubators. And that's kind of happening. And this is happening in Texas, mm-hmm. in Port Arthur, Texas, not, you know, the state that's most known for progressive policies. And also on Long Island, where Stony Brook University is, we are, you know, working with indigenous communities, and Suffolk County, again, another very conservative community. But when you're focusing on issues locally that kind of impact both, you know, housing, education, and environment, so you're not necessarily prioritizing environment, but a lot of injustices that go together, there have been policy changes that bring together the cumulative impacts.
I'll just jump into a very quick
yes,
one,
please,
which is on, because you're talking about reparations. Yeah. So New York and Vermont, just last year, or towards the end of the year before, passed laws that make fossil fuel companies pay reparations for the harms that are that their emissions cause. So there you have the environmental aspect, the social justice aspect, you know, all the forms that are mentioned here. So that's really nice and concrete. And that's also being considered in a whole range of other states, including California. And Tom Steyer, who spoke here, may well be the next governor of California, is in favor of it. So, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Last question before we pass on to the audience. And this is my favorite question, too. If there is one mindset shift you want every reader to walk away with after finishing this book, what would it be?
I think I'm sort of reminded of this quote that my well-being and liberation are tied with yours. Mm-hmm. But collectively, you know, no matter where we live, global north, south, who we are, if we don't see ourselves connected and working together, I think, you know, we need to sort of expand and be more capacious in our understanding of our world.
Thank you. Thank you, Manisha. Mary Robinson.
I think I would urge long-term thinking, which also includes future generations, so that every decision is thought about what are the consequences.
Yeah.
So much at the moment is short-term, political, popular, pleasing the voter.
Yeah.
I think the mindset now needs to be, because we have so many crises, especially the climate, nature, and inequality crises, we have to think long term.
Thank you very much. Ashfaq, you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say for me it would be that I won't use social contract, but I'll say that we have to heal our relationship with nature. I think it's at the core of what's driving economic exploitation. When you go back to it, you know, what drives the mindset shift that we need to actually repair that relationship and rediscover and resurface those values that are more relational.
Yeah.
And I think that could take us in a very different direction heading at the moment.
Thank you very much, Najma. Thank you all so much for your reflections. We'll now open the floor to the questions from the audience, both in person and online. Please type short questions into your Q&A box, and we will try to answer as many as possible. Please, if possible, include your name and affiliation. And for those present here, please raise your hand and I will select questions in rounds. Okay, first we take questions from the audience here, and we have Naila and one there, and three questions first, yeah, and later.
I'm very good at short questions.
Yeah, please be short. Make the questions short, yeah.
It's not on.
To make that happen, was giving us a different term. And we're talking about quite isolated, with very powerful potential. So I wondered if you would have any lesson about how we can stitch these things together and make them mean more, something larger.
Thank you, Naila. We take a couple of questions more. One there, sir, please.
I don't think the mic is working.
I don't think it's working.
Yeah, the mic doesn't seem to be working, but we heard you.
None of them?
Is this the questions there?
I think they are. Oh, yes, please. Yeah.
It's about the knowledge gap. There's no knowledge gap. There's a funding gap. And we've seen the example of how whole governments like the UK has been brought down because the bond market couldn't find a way to invest. And famously, Liz Truss's government lasted for the lifetime of a Tesco lettuce. The bond market is searching everywhere to find an investable proposition that incorporates nature-based solutions together with eco-social contracts. And the structure is already there in green, social, sustainable impact bonds. What's the problem?
It's a good question. One more question.
You had a question, yes, go ahead. Yes, you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Could we answer these questions first, and then we will take more questions? Yeah. Anyone of you, please.
I guess I'll answer Naila's question, because in a way, I think feminists have been demonstrating how to kind of scale out rather than scale up, and stitching, I think, what you're saying, weaving together. And again, the example of SEWA is a good one. They've been working across South Asia. Another group that I work with, Swayam Shikshan Prayog, which is also women farmers in Maharashtra, they've been working with 10 states in India and others. So I think these, a lot of the small groups are recognizing that, powerful as their local examples are, they need to be working with others. And so, you know, SEWA now works with over 300,000, half a million people, so does Swayam Shikshan Prayog, working across 300,000 villages. So yes, it's not all of India or all of even South Asia, but I think people are recognizing that that needs to happen, and you're absolutely right. It's not about scaling up, because that makes no sense, I think, scaling up. And I want to respond to your question. I don't know the UK politics, but I think for me it's not a funding gap, because funding already implies who's going to fund. I think what we need is, we have a different political economy. We're not going to need those kind of funds. We're going to, in some ways, invest and organize our political economy so that there's not going to be a funder who's going to ensure that, that we're going to have funds to organize and do things the way we think is going to be more equitable and just. So that's not an answer to your question, but
there's a $1 trillion standing there waiting. Where's the problem?
Wonderful, if there's $1 trillion, you know, who's going to get those $1 trillion?
It's the investable proposition.
I'd love to, but not from the book, but from my own experience of working in nature-based solutions. I think there's the change in mindset and thinking of the financiers themselves needs to change when they think what's investable and what's not, because they have got a mindset of the kind of returns that they expect. And if you design and deliver a project in a different way, working with nature, respecting the limits, you are not going to deliver it in the same way that we've done for the last 300 years. You are going to have to accept multiple returns on investment and truly value social and ecological returns on investment. And they struggle to do that. They want financial returns on investment. And I hope there are economics professors or your people who are in that. Economics education has to change. Mm-hmm. So that the mindset that they come in and they look at what's a bankable project, they actually have got, you know, the ability to see that those medium to longer term, exactly what Mary said, the longer term thinking is holding us back from being able to do the kind of investments that are going to deliver longer term resilience and sustainability. I feel for them. I work with investors and financiers a lot, and I know that they struggle. In a sense, the the public investors, the sort of development finance institutes, in a sense, because their mandates is slightly different, are easier to convince, but it's not an easy community to convince because the thinking has to change.
So what's the problem?
The thinking. On what multiple?
And they've got the money.
Yeah.
Where's the eco-social contract that delivers that?
Someone else's turn.
Yeah. Now,
Mary, why don't you respond?
The small examples, which we all know, wonderful examples, I think the importance is to tell the stories. Yeah. And that's one of the things that Project Dandelion is trying to do. In fact, a lot of our lead women leaders are great communicators themselves and are telling the stories, communicating to their social networks, etc. And it's a little bit the same with the question about how to have, you know, the grassroots organizations that are there, you know, play a more meaningful role, play a stronger role. I think it's telling the stories, getting them known. I'm incredibly impressed with so many young climate activists that I know because they have large social media followers. They're doing so much. Vanessa Nakate, Shia, I've gotten her second name now because I'm an elder, but you know, they're just incredible. So it's about the stories. On the money, the money is extremely important. I mean, it is possible, and in fact, it's the reality, that the climate and nature crisis is totally scary, and it is on our watch, and it is very urgent. And when people hear just how urgent it is, or we may lose the coral reefs. We know that small island states may go under, all kinds of things that are now really going to happen very, very soon. The answer is to switch the money. Stop subsidizing what is harming us. I mean, the fact that we spend, $8 trillion a year on subsidies of what is harming us. We need to shift that. So we need a leadership. Unfortunately, there's a certain leader of a big country that has a different vision, and I think his different vision is short-term transactional money-making. Mm-hmm. That's it. And he doesn't want to or think about the impact. But, I think that the fact that we will have a good discussion in Colombia at the end of April on just transition from fossil fuel, the beginnings of the treaty, the non-proliferation fossil fuel treaty, but it's the process and the roadmaps that countries should have to get out of fossil fuel is very much part of the problem. And then it's not just a just transition out, it's also a just transition in, into affordable, accessible clean energy. And it's unfortunately all too often neither affordable enough or accessible enough. We need to plan that much more than we're doing. And I think the eco-social contract approach would help us.
I know there are many hands here, but we also have some questions online. And we will take that for this round and then come back again to the hall. Mara, please.
Is this working now?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Okay.
One question upstairs.
Sorry. We'll come back to you after the online round. Yeah.
Okay, this is from Dr. Benedict Vassi, who works for Triodos Bank in Spain. How do you see the balance between public governance and private initiatives in this? Should we wait for regulation to impose change, or should we catalyse change through private initiatives? I work for a bank that for over 40 years has been channeling the savings and investments of like-minded individuals into transformational projects. So there's clearly a bit of a plug there for Triodos Bank, but you get the gist of it for that one.
Yeah,
Should I go to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay. This is from a postgrad student studying social policy at LSE. Drawing on my previous experience in resource mobilisation for international organisations, I've observed firsthand how crucial narrative framing is to securing public and political support. While human rights framing has traditionally formed the foundation of many social policy arguments, do you think this approach remains sufficient in an era of uncertainty? Or should we reconsider how we frame social issues in order to sustain future support? So that's querying whether the narrative framing is correct. Got room for one more?
I think maybe two is enough for the day. Sorry. Would you like to answer these two questions? Or the question about the private and public initiative and the one on LSE students?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think those binaries in some ways are problematic to begin with. I think the issues we have are so vast and so critical that we need initiatives from everywhere and all sectors. So I don't know that, you know, one needs to wait for the other. I think initiatives can happen both in the private arena as well as in the regulatory and the space of the state, as well as multilateral institutions. So I don't see that as an issue. And in terms of, you know, the second question, which is narrative changing, I think that is true. And I think that was part of what we were saying in terms of reframing and the epistemic justice, that there are different kinds of stories that we need to tell, that human rights in some ways had become so overused and overdetermined for the last 20, 30 years that people are beginning to think about different ways of talking about social justice. So I think, yes, the narratives do matter. And not all narratives are going to resonate everywhere. That's kind of, you know, the other things we need to be concerned about, that it is context specific. And while we all live in a global world and see things, you know, instantly all over, nonetheless, what resonates with people on the ground is not going to be the same everywhere. So I think, yeah, how we frame our narratives and how context specific they are will matter.
Thank you.
So on the certainly the private has a huge role to play. And on the gentleman's question, Lisa Sachs does a lot of work on this. There's a great podcast she did with, on the Zero podcast. So there's a lot that can be done to get investors to invest in, you know, renewable energy, some forms of adaptation. But we have to recognize that many of the people who are particularly affected by, mainly the communities who are particularly affected by climate and other nature crises, aren't really able to pay. I mean, they're the worst off, and there will have to be a mixture, and there will need to be significant public funding provided to help address this. Now, in terms of the narrative framing, so eco-social contracts is not something you want to put on a placard. So we definitely need to. What are the, you know, what is it going to be? What are the terms that are going to? Is it going to be? Is it polluters pay? What's the, you know, what's the civil rights or votes for women? You know, that worked in the past. That's going to work for this. So we don't have the expertise. Maybe Mary does, but the rest of us don't. So, but you know, I'm really looking to many of you to come up with that answer. Thank you.
We're taking the next round. We have one question from the balcony, and then here. There, and the fourth from here. Sorry, I don't know the names.
Thank you very much. Please. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the gentleman that pointed me out. Thank you very much for the wonderful panel. As an Irish citizen, particularly seeing Mary there, very proud of her and everything you're all doing. Just to change the subject just slightly on a different angle, I spoke about ecocide at the International Bar Association in Mexico last year and Toronto this year. What about ecocide? Because we seem to be quite a lot of carrot, and everyone's telling us about great things. And as Mary said, the amazing emergency we're facing now. But do we need a bit more stick rather than just carrot? And for example, the French, the Belgians, 17 other countries, and now even the Scottish, are just about to pass new ecocide legislation where the maximum imprisonment is 20 years inside for directors not taking this seriously enough, and also an amendment to the Treaty of Rome alongside war crimes. So I know it's slightly, Mr. Chair, a little bit different, but I'm just wondering whether we now need to move to carrot. Sorry, to stick, not carrot. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
One question from here.
Anis Nasir.
Please make your questions short.
Well, I'll try.
Yeah.
Anis Nasir.
Everybody.
Retired banker of City of London for 47 years. If I take this opportunity to just congratulate Mrs. Mary Robinson for all the wonderful work she has achieved, everything. And she's still going strong, and may you carry on like that for another few years. And of course, I'm most concerned about the way we are treating the planet. And of course, thanks to a panel, a learned panel like you, who are keeping the momentum going. Now, Trump has torn up all the international agreement on everything, whether it's climate change or geopolitical. And you think, he seemed to have derailed all the effort that is being made to improve the eco-social contract and so on. And, how long you think can everything be put back on track again to improve the things?
Yeah. The third question from there, we'll come back to all the answers later. Yes.
Here?
And no, behind you. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the panel for, I think, giving us all so much food for thought. I think my question is that right now across the world, there's almost a movement of states looking inwards in terms of defining who they see as the legitimate constituent of asking the right questions and whose demands need to be met, especially when we're having conversations around migration. At the same time, with the climate challenge, we are seeing a movement outwards where we need solidarity, which is not just concern and constrain within the borders, but also like in the SIDS, where we are seeing now relocation happening across different nation states. I wanted to understand, how do we really imagine social contracts between citizens and state where existing social contracts didn't exist? And I think to a great extent, this question might be for Professor Desai, but I would really appreciate a comment on that how do we really imagine these two parallel trends that are going on and make almost migration depoliticized in some way to make it part of the conversation in a legitimate way.
Thank you. Last question for this round. Yes, please.
Yeah, thank you. I'm interested in this notion of transitional stories and narratives as a move between traditional forms of living, for instance, in the west of Ireland, in Mayo, my heritage, I think, one of our learned speakers' heritage, where turf is an immediate form of heat, very cheap, it's just outside the door. How do we work with the local people to get a convincing story of change for affordable energy that makes sense culturally and doesn't rely on surveillance from drones, which is happening in the country at the moment? So I think it's quite a complex story that actually is not conceptual and theoretical, but practical and meaningful and linked to traditions.
Thank you. Would you like to respond? Starting from the stick story there.
I think actually there's a fantastic contribution in the book that actually speaks about ecocide and proposes an international court for the environment, like the International Court of Justice. I absolutely agree with the fact that we've got to, elevate, the rights of nature to that level, because it's an existential right. I mean, I think we can pretty much see that they are often two sides of the same coin, genocide and ecocide, as we're beginning to see in the places that have experienced, that level of violence. And as we speak about in the book quite clearly, is that very often violence against people goes hand in hand with violence against the earth and against the climate system. So there's some really bold, there's one chapter on earth system governance that actually goes very much into ecocide. I wanted to just respond quickly to something that was mentioned earlier about private sector. And I think I agree with Manisha about, that the binaries between, private sector and the regulation that governments is not always helpful, but coming from a part of the world where the hold of private sector over governments is unhealthy, to be it politely, and corporations hold sway economically and politically, I do think that there's a much stronger role for the state in many contexts where private sector is wreaking havoc with people's lives and with the environment. So I just say you've got to kind of like balance and understand the context that the private sector generates.
Yeah, but the state everywhere are so beholden to the corporate sector that I don't know that that, you know, distinction holds true in most places anyway.
Response to the gentleman there.
Terry, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I wanted to take up the question about the steps that President Trump has taken in the United States. These are entirely reversible if the politics change, if the checks come with the midterm elections, for example, especially if the Democrats manage to get to gain both houses, that would be a check. The Supreme Court is a sort of check, not much of a check, not as much as it should be, but maybe on the tariffs, maybe will be a check. There seems to be an expectation that it may, that they may find on that, which would be interesting. So it is reversible. It's very harmful in the short term, but the point has been well made. And I've met them at COPs, I've met them in the Munich Security Conference, I've met them everywhere. The Americans who are, you know, we are still in and we are fighting as hard as we can. And we know, you know, Governor Newsom was there, Senator Coombs, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, they're all trying to make the case that America is still trying to be on the right path, but it's obviously very damaging. What I have to say worried me about the Munich Security Conference was the focus on militarization, the focus on arming, because we're preparing for war. We're preparing for war. It's almost as if this is something that we really want to do, you know. It's kind of, I mean, it really was really, you know, kind of tangible. We need, unfortunately, the peace negotiations are two guys who don't actually have much experience in diplomacy. Trying to solve three global problems, you know. It's a pretty fragile basis, if I may say so, with respect or not.
I was going to respond to the migration question that you asked. And I think you're right. I mean, we already have, in some ways, thinking around climate refugees. And so we're talking about migration, which is both voluntary, you know, in some ways forced migration, because if, you know, you no longer have your home where you're able to live, it's forced migration. And so I think you're right. And that tendency, along with the rise of, you know, a lack of democracy and, you know, the lack of expansion of rights to even the citizens, much less to migrants, which is what we're seeing in the U.S., is, I think, a big issue. And I don't know that, you know, there are easy solutions to that. I think the only ways in which one can address a lack of democracy is by people, you know, showing up, right, for when elections happen. And unfortunately, election is just one small indicator of politics, but nonetheless, those who get into power, you know, can make some changes. And I live in New York City, and I'm very happy to say that we have Mamdani, and we have, you know, great hopes that, you know, electing the right people can make some kind of change. But yeah, no, I think it's we are in a very difficult situation, but there are also thoughts around climate refugees and legislation around that. So while we, you know, have these contradictory tendencies right now, I think there's also a way in which we are thinking that we're going to have to think about this, because we all might be climate refugees someday. There might be very few places on Earth that will be left where humans can survive and thrive. So I know it's not much of an answer, but it's...
Yes.
I have something tiny to add to that. And it's something I've always thought about, but I've not seen good articulations of it. But I think, like, if we engage in our democratic processes, not from the sort of scale, the geography, if we don't take nations, but if we take landscapes or seascapes, then we begin to understand our shared space in a different way, not by a border, you know, but by the place that we inhabit together, and the fact that that place, is the security of all of us is threatened, for example, in small island and developing states. And I do think, you know, I mean, that's, I guess, with some of the chapters in the book take us to, like, around earth democracy, ecological democracy, starting to think not in the confines of cities, states, but to begin to think of seascapes, landscapes, watersheds, river basins. It's just, it changes how you speak to one another and how you connect to one another when you connect to something that big that you all depend on. And I think that's part of what bringing that sort of relational values back into the sort of democratic space. I haven't seen that many examples. Again, I think Indigenous people think and believe in that way, but our political systems don't.
We can take two questions, just two questions. One here and one from online audience. Mara, you want to read out? Just one question, yeah.
Sure. This is from Hadija, who's a current AFSI fellow at LSE. In most global south countries, especially pastoralist communities, women face overlapping challenges of climate change, gender inequality, and marginalisation based on geographical or ethnicity. How do eco-social contracts account for these intersecting inequalities? And how can they strengthen women's resilience in ways that are culturally appropriate and sustainable?
Thank you, Mara. That's a very interesting question. And the last question for the day.
Thank you so much. I'm Juan David Naranjo. I'm from Colombia, a Master of Public Policy student here at LSE. And my question, I really appreciated what you mentioned about bringing together different perspectives from different religions. And my question is if you included something related to LGBTQ plus rights in this eco-social contract, taking into account that many religious institutions believe those rights are not necessarily ones that should be on the table right now. And I ask this question also, like, as a diverse guy whose mother, Catholic mother, has rejected his decision, but also because I know Mary Robinson worked in Ireland to legalize homosexuality back in the 90s, but having like so many countries, again, Muslim countries, countries with very Catholic and Christian tradition rejecting those rights, I would like to know what you thought of it in this contract. And just quickly, what did you think about democracy or the power of the people in this contract? I know you've mentioned something, but I want to know if you've thought about some sort of way of deciding what societies want and moving forward based on those decisions.
Short answers. And my colleagues had told me I can take 3 minutes extra. So we're going to finish in 3 minutes. Yes.
I'll respond to the question online.
Online.
And I think the example that I was going to give of the women farmers in India, they're precisely working on all of those aspects. That is, they started off, this is an area in India where there were a lot of farmer suicides. And those farmer suicides were happening because the farmers were indebted due to borrowing, for pesticides and various other chemical fertilizers. The women began to recognize that we weren't having these suicides before we started developing and using cash crops such as cotton and sugarcane. And so they began to make a shift from the crops that they were using. And in the process of making that shift agriculturally in terms of seeds, the crops, they also began to rethink the social relationships within. So they were, for example, working against violence against women in the household. They also became much more active in their local panchayat, which are local governance systems in India, which are constitutionally mandated across all the local and village level panchayats. And so they began to, become active in that. So I think, but what helped all of these women was the fact that there was a women's organization working with them. So I think when you have collective support of a political organization, a feminist organization that enables them to address all of these issues together, I think that's where kind of the eco-social contract comes into place, is when you work on issues that are clearly all related, and that includes, the question that you asked. I don't think that any of the chapters specifically mentions that. Maybe Chris Walker's did. But they talk about social rights, across inequalities. And so, it's not directly, I don't think, addressed in any particular chapter, right? I'm trying to remember. We have 20 chapters, so I'm kind of...
Yeah. Do you want to respond to who?
Yeah.
I think it's important that we recognize that we have actually entered an era of a serious culture war now. It's a really serious culture war. It was very clear at the Munich conference that I've just come from. The United States administration is fighting for a world that is white, Christian, nationalist. It's
and a gender binary. I mean, let's not forget the anti-gender ideology movement that is very strongly rooted here, the TERFs, and people elsewhere.
Yeah. So women's rights, LGBTI rights are all very vulnerable. There is going to be a lot of money going into all of the EU countries, including Ireland, to support any right-wing traditional family trad wife, which means traditional wife, you know, it's a serious culture war. We have to be prepared for it, and we have to be, you know, aware that we have to wake up and fight back as hard as we can for these rights. Countries can go forward or they can go backwards. The United States and many states now, and overall in the federal system, is going backwards. And it's very alarming, but they're trying to do the same. Yeah. And there is a lot of tech billionaire money. it is supporting this. And let us have no illusions. Yeah. It's a very serious time. In many ways, social media is unhelpful because it's a channel to, you know, helping to destabilize democracies, let's put it that way. No illusions now. A very different world, a world where we have a cultural fight on our hands for the kind of democracy and freedoms that we've, and human rights, women's rights, LGBTI rights, all of these rights are to be fought for now in a way that wasn't true even a few years ago. So I think, you know, what gives me hope is people are up for this fight. we will go forward.
Okay. It's been a pleasure for me to chair this today's event. Thank you very much to our speakers for presenting. And thank you everyone in the audience who joined us. Please remember to scan the QR code on the screen to download an open access copy of the Eco-Social Contracts for Sustainable and Just Futures, Mobilizing Collective Power to Deal with the 21st Century Poly Crisis. You can also use the same link to purchase the book as a hard copy. Until we meet again, virtually or otherwise, thank you and goodbye.
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.